Hi, everybody. It's Derek, and this is your Foreign Exchanges World News Roundup for Saturday, April 13th and Sunday, April 14th, 2024. We have some anniversaries. On April 13th, 1953, Central Intelligence Agency Director Alan Dulles ordered the creation of Project MKUltra, the infamous Project MKUltra, a program for human experimentation into mind control drugs and techniques. Among its more unsavory components were experiments in which human subjects, often pulled involuntarily from prisons and mental institutions, were dosed with drugs, LSD in particular, usually without their consent. Some of the techniques MKUltra tested eventually found their way into George W. Bush's enhanced interrogation, i.e. torture program, and it has spawned innumerable conspiracy theories since the revelation of its existence in the 1970s. On April 13th, 1975, an attack by Christian phalangist militia fighters on a bus carrying Palestinian fighters and civilians in eastern Beirut triggered the Lebanese Civil War, the start of the Lebanese Civil War. There's a piece about this in the newsletter that you can read if you'd like more detail. The short version of this is that earlier in the day, a car had performed a drive-by shooting on a Greek Orthodox church in the Ain al Ramana neighborhood of eastern Beirut that killed a number of phalangist figures. The car was plastered with logos, stickers, regalia of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine to such an extent that most people now believe that this was a different group that had carried out the attack and tried to frame the PFLP. The frame stuck because the phalangists were already, itching for a fight with the PLO at this point. And so they found themselves a bus carrying Palestinians, some PLO fighters, some civilians, through the same neighborhood, Ain al Ramana, later in the day, and shot it up, killed 27 people. And from that point on, the rest is, as they say, history, and the Lebanese Civil War was on. On April 14th, 43 BCE, the legions of Mark Antony won a victory and suffered a defeat on the same day in the Battle of Forum Gallorum in northern Italy. Antony was confronted by a Republican army under the command of that year's consuls, Aulus Hirtius and Gaius Vibius Pansa. They were bolstered by a group of Julius Caesar's veterans led by Octavian. Antony's army attacked Pansa's part of the army and won a fleeting victory before an attack by Hirtius forced Antony to withdraw. Pansa was badly wounded and would die on April 22nd. The outcome of Forum Gallorum was inconclusive, as you might have seen there, and it led to a second, more decisive engagement, the Battle of Mutina, a week later. On April 14th, 1912, shortly before midnight, the allegedly unsinkable ocean liner RMS Titanic struck an iceberg and began sinking, in part due to the fact that it carried enough lifeboats for only about half of the passengers on board and a third of the passengers that it could have carried at full capacity. The Titanic sinking became one of the biggest maritime disasters in history, killing more than 1,500 people. Moving on to the news, we start in the Middle East with Israel-Palestine. Gaza ceasefire negotiations are going badly enough that instead of actually negotiating, the Israeli government and Hamas are blaming one another for impeding progress toward a deal. On Saturday, prior to the Iranian attack on Israel, which we'll get to below in a moment, Hamas delivered its response to the latest offer on the table, and needless to say, it wasn't yes. The group has apparently not budged on its demands for an indefinite ceasefire and the Israeli military or IDF's full withdrawal from Gaza, while the Israelis have not budged in their strict rejection of those terms. In Gaza, meanwhile, there were reports on Sunday that the IDF was allowing women, at least, to pass through its checkpoint from the southern into the northern part of the territory. As far as I know, the IDF hasn't confirmed any policy shifts, so it's unclear what's happening or how many people have been able to return to northern Gaza. In the West Bank, Israeli settler mobs attacked several Palestinian villages near Ramallah on Friday after a 14-year-old settler was reported missing. The violence resumed on Saturday after authorities discovered the body of the missing settler, and the IDF claimed that he was the victim of a quote-unquote terrorist attack. The mob killed at least one Palestinian on Friday and wounded dozens more while destroying several homes and other property. In Lebanon, the IDF attacked a building apparently belonging to Hezbollah near the eastern Lebanese city of Baalbek on Sunday. There were no casualties, but this is another Israeli strike well north of the border region and reflects the continued expansion of the Israeli Hezbollah back and forth to more distant parts of Lebanon. In Iran, this is probably why you're all here, in the wake of Iran's overnight drone and missile strike against Israel, which I talked about in the lead up to it happening in the week in review. You can see that was sent out on Saturday. My sense in the wake of this is that it was larger than it might have been hoped, but less serious than it appeared in the moment. The attack involved over 300 projectiles, that's drones as well as ballistic and cruise missiles, but most of them appear to have been intercepted by Israeli air defense systems supplemented by the US, UK, French, and Jordanian militaries. Those that did make it to target appear to have hit exclusively military sites concentrated in the occupied Golan region and the Negev Desert in southern Israel. There have been reports of injuries, but no deaths, at least not yet. And in terms of damage, accounts vary all the way from none, which is the Israeli story, to extensive. That's the Iranian story. Both parties here have incentive to exaggerate in either direction. But more objective estimates, possibly complicated by Israeli restrictions on media access, suggest the damage was relatively limited. If you peruse those corners of the media slash analysis landscape that are constantly urging war with Iran, the consensus appears to be that this attack was intended to cause vast damage and high casualties, but that Israel and companies successfully thwarted it. I don't think that's accurate. The nearly 2 weeks that passed after Israel's attack on that Iranian consular building in Damascus on April 1st suggest the Iranians were carefully considering how to retaliate without triggering further escalation, and that they wanted to give the Israeli and U.S. governments plenty of time to prepare for what was coming. There have been several reports that the Iranian government communicated its plans, in a broad sense at least, to the U.S. through regional intermediaries, including a message sent via the Turkish government just before the attack was launched. And the message out of Tehran on Sunday has been that the Iranians are prepared to consider the matter closed, but reserve the right to attack again should the Israelis retaliate. This all points toward the Iranians intending the effect of their attack to be more symbolic than tangible, to send a message without giving the Israelis much of an excuse to continue spiraling this situation into a full-blown regional war. What remains to be seen is whether the Israeli government is going to avail itself of this opportunity to hop off the ride. It's mildly promising to see the Israeli rhetoric since the attack focusing on the defensive success rather than the need for retaliation. It may also be promising that Joe Biden has reportedly told Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that the U.S. will not support an Israeli attack on Iran. Biden on Sunday got his fellow G7 leaders to condemn the Iranian attack, which was undoubtedly meant to assuage Netanyahu. I feel fairly certain there will be an Israeli response to this attack, but that response could also be carefully calibrated to give Israel the last word without risking further escalation. The big risk here is that Netanyahu is so hell-bent on war for his own petty reasons that he's committed to escalation no matter what. We don't know exactly what Biden said to him after the attack, but in point of fact, Netanyahu doesn't need U.S. support to attack Iran. He needs U.S. support to shield Israel from further retaliation. If Biden's ironclad commitment to Israeli security extends to protecting it from the consequences of another provocative attack against Iran, then his "you're on your own" message to Netanyahu is meaningless. Moving on to Asia and Pakistan, that bus hijacking in the Balochistan province on Friday left at least 11 people dead, 2 killed in an initial attack on a car, and 9, not 8 as previously reported, who were taken from the bus and killed. There's still no clear indication as to the identity of the attackers, but witness accounts have them selecting those 9 people from the bus because they were apparently Punjabi. This suggests that this was some sort of Baloch nationalist group that carried out the attack. In Indonesia, the Indonesian military is having to deny reports that its airstrikes risked the life of kidnapped New Zealand pilot Philip Mertens. He was abducted by West Papua National Liberation Army militants back in February 2023. We covered this in the newsletter at the time. The militants have released a new video in which he claims that Indonesian airstrikes have forced his relocation due to safety concerns, an assertion the Indonesian military labeled a quote-unquote hoax. The West Papua National Liberation Army says it will only release Mertens in the context of a United Nations-mediated negotiation. In Africa, in Niger, thousands of people reportedly protested in Niamey on Saturday, demanding the expulsion of the U.S. military from Niger. The military junta currently ruling that country announced last month that it is canceling the military cooperation agreement under which U.S. forces are currently stationed there. But the Pentagon has played dumb since then, and there's no movement, apparently, of U.S. forces out of the country. Saturday's protests echoed demonstrations after the junta seized power last July over the continued French military presence in the country. In Somalia, the MV Abdullah, a cargo ship seized by Somali pirates last month, has been released after the payment of $5 million in ransom, according to the pirates themselves. It's unclear who came up with the money. The vessel is Bangladeshi and was carrying cargo to the UAE when it was taken. In the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Allied Democratic Forces militants are believed to have been responsible for several attacks in the vicinity of the town of Beni in the eastern DRC's North Kivu province throughout the weekend. They killed at least 10 and perhaps 14 or more civilians. In Europe, in Ukraine, according to Russian officials, the Ukrainian military killed at least 16 people and wounded 20 more late Friday when it shelled the town of Tokmak in Ukraine's Zaporizhia Oblast. There's no way to confirm the casualty count. On Saturday, the Russian military said that its forces had captured the village of Pervomaiskye near Avdiivka, though again, that's unconfirmed. Ukraine's overall military commander, Oleksandr Sirsky, said on Sunday that he believes the Russians are hoping to take the town of Chasiv Yar by May 9th, which is the date that Moscow celebrates the Soviet victory over Nazi Germany in World War II. The Russian military has seemingly made Chasiv Yar the focus of its attention over the past few weeks. If/when they take that town, they will have a clear line of advance on the city of Kramatorsk to the northwest. In the Americas, in Haiti, the big transitional council has run into something of a rough patch. The constituencies backing its 9 members, 7 political parties and 2 interest groups, are unhappy with the notice that appeared in the Haitian Government Gazette on Friday. We covered this in the newsletter, announcing the council's formation, claiming that it includes, quote unquote, major modifications that, quote unquote, distort the council's agenda. The announcement's wording suggests that the composition of the council is ultimately subject to final approval by outgoing, I guess, Haitian Prime Minister Ariel Henry, which apparently wasn't part of the deal, according to the stakeholders. Coverage of the announcement on Friday also noted that it indicated that Henry is only going to step down when, or maybe we should ask if at this point, the council appoints his successor, when previous reporting had suggested that he would resign when the council took office. And finally, in the United States, William Astor at Tom Dispatch considers America's addiction to war. Let me read you the introduction to his piece. When I was in the U.S. military, I learned a saying often wrongly attributed to the Greek philosopher Plato that only the dead have seen the end of war. Its persistence through history to this very moment should indeed be sobering. What would it take for us humans to stop killing each other with such vigor and in such numbers? Song lyrics tell me to be proud to be an American, yet war and profligate preparations for more of the same are omnipresent here. My government spends more in its military than the next 10 countries combined, and most of them are allies. In this century, our leaders have twice warned of an axis of evil intent on harming us, whether the fantasy troika of Iraq, Iran, and North Korea cited by President George W. Bush early in 2002, or a new one, China, Russia, and North Korea in the Indo-Pacific today. Predictably, given that sort of threat inflation, this country is now closing in on $1 trillion a year in defense spending, or close to 2/3 of federal discretionary spending, in the name of having a military machine capable of defeating evil troikas, as well as combating global terrorism. A significant part of that huge sum is reserved for producing a new generation of nuclear weapons that will be quite capable of destroying this planet with missiles and warheads to spare. My country, to be blunt, has long been addicted to war, killing, violence, and massive preparations for more of the same. We need an intervention. We need to confront our addiction. Yet when it comes to war and preparations for future conflicts, our leaders aren't even close to hitting rock bottom. They remain in remarkable denial and see no reason to change their ways. On that note, that's all for us this weekend. I hope you had a good one. Thanks to all of you for reading and listening to the newsletter, and especially to those of you who are Foreign Exchange's subscribers. And until next time, take care, and I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.